Welcome to RHRealityCheck.org's RealityCast, where we inject truth into the sex and reproductive health debate. Each week, we'll be bringing you news, opinion, and advice on sexual health issues, as well as interviews with some of the most prominent names in sexual health advocacy. Here's your host, Amanda Marcotte.
On this edition of RealityCast, I have to ask, did you hear that a healthcare reform bill was signed? I'm guessing you did, but I'm going to look a little deeper into how Congress and the President got the bill past anti-choicers and what that means for the country. Also, author Susan Douglas will be on to talk about her new book, Enlightened Sexism. A new video from the Center for Reproductive Rights has gone the way of cute. In it, we see a couple of cuddly bunnies talking about a whoops moment in bed.
It broke?
I can't believe it.
At least there's the morning after pill.
Yeah, but the way they make you get it is so embarrassing.
Wait, I thought you didn't need a prescription anymore.
Well, you don't, but you still have to go to the pharmacist, show your ID, and if you're lucky, escape without the stares of shame.
Yikes. Why can't you buy it like a condom?
Excellent question. Scientists say there are no medical grounds for limiting access to emergency contraception. But instead of putting our health first, the Food and Drug Administration overruled their own scientists and bowed to political pressure.
Whoa.
It's been a year since the FDA was ordered to revisit the decision to make women ask the pharmacist directly for emergency contraception, as if it were a dangerous drug, which it is not. If you go to the action page linked in the show notes, you can tell the FDA to stop goofing around and let women have better access to emergency contraception. I realize the stakes of politics are probably too high to say this, but let's face it, politics is a sport. Granted, it's a sport like Calvin Ball, where the rules change all the time. And to make it worse, the referees and the media are less fair than the ones in the NBA. But like sports, a big part of politics is knowing your opponent's game and their weaknesses, and using that knowledge to your advantage. I have to say that I think healthcare reform proponents figured this strategy out, finally, with Bart Stupak. What have we learned about Bart Stupak in the past few months? That he refuses to read bills, for one thing, or he'd know that the federal funding for abortion he's claiming is in the healthcare bill isn't there. We know that he's got a huge ego, and like most anti-choicers, is big on displays of dominance and submission. And we know that he thinks women are feeble-minded. Witness his contempt for the intelligence of nuns on Chris Matthews' show.
Well, with all due respect to the nuns, when I deal or... when we're working on right-to-life issues, we don't call the nuns. I mean, we deal with right-to-life. We deal with the U.S. Conference of Catholic Bishops. I mean,
why are the bishops more reliable than the nuns?
Well, because I don't think I've ever been, in my 18 years, I don't think I've ever had been contacted by the nuns to on legislation. It's seldom do you see them. They're not considered one of the groups that's actively involved up here on issues. They may surface, they may write a letter.
Even Matthews was blown away by the seething contempt for the idea that nuns have an opinion that counts. Nuns! Who cares what nuns think about women's health care? They're just women. Here's some authorities, some male authorities, here to tell us what to do about women. Women, you can sit down and let men make all the decisions for you. Much fun was made of Stupak tipping his hat to the misogyny and contempt for female intelligence implicit in his waving off of the nuns. Jody at RH Reality Check made fun of it. Rachel Maddow made fun of it. Laura Flanders made fun of it.
He's had to deal, for example, with receiving letters from religious leaders representing 59,000 Catholic nuns. Of the letters sent to Congress this week calling healthcare reform the real pro-life stance, Stupak said, "When I'm drafting right-to-life language, I don't call up nuns. They're only women, after all. Women, as Jody Jacobson at RH Reality Check noted, who do the real work of ministering to women in need."
I'm sure the idea of how to handle the Stupak problem had already occurred to Democratic leaders before the nuns' comment. But still, part of me kind of imagines they thought this. Hey, wait a minute. We keep calling Bart and telling him there's no federal funding for abortion. We keep going on TV and saying it. We keep saying it and saying it, but he refuses to listen. Could it be who we're asking to speak on this? Think about it. All this time, I've been playing clips from Kathleen Sebelius, Nancy Pelosi, Claire McCaskill, Cecil Richards, etc. I could go on, but you get the idea. When the subject is abortion, they send out the ladies. And Bart Stupak doesn't listen to ladies when they're talking about male property such as uteruses. So they called in a man to tell him.
One thing that could be helpful to Democrats is what Mike mentioned. If the president signs an executive order dealing with no federal funding linked to abortion and abortion insurance coverage, that might open up a few more votes.
Granted, I don't think it's just his misogyny that made Stupak listen to Obama and not to anyone else who's been dealing with him on this. The ego and that anti-choicer love of submission and dominance was also used against him to get this concession. Having the President of the United States grovel a little before him will probably give Stupak a major ego thrill that will last even if he's kicked out of office in the primary for these shenanigans. All this time, Bart Stupak has been coddled by right-wingers who see him as a useful idiot in their attempts to squash healthcare reform. But as you can imagine, they stopped pretending to be his friend the second he switched to a yes vote. After the bill was passed, Stupak got up to speak and was taunted with cries of, "Baby killer." That was the clearest one from Republican Representative Randy Neubauer, but there were others. I doubt Stupak will learn his lesson from the incident, but the rest of us should take note. The term baby killer doesn't mean someone who actually kills babies, and it doesn't necessarily have any relationship to abortion either. It's just using people's fear of female sexuality as a tool to smear your political opponents. Since our maternal and infant mortality rate is relatively high in the U.S., due to huge gaps in the healthcare system, Stupak's vote actually puts him on the team of baby savers with the hated pro-choicers who care about real people's health. Calling someone a baby killer is just something right-wingers do to put down anyone who disagrees with them. In about 10 years, they're going to call you a baby killer if you sign up for WIC in order to feed your baby. I'd like to welcome Susan Douglas to the program. Susan is a professor of communication studies and teaches at the University of Michigan. She's also a feminist author who has penned a number of books and is here today to talk about her newest work of media criticism, Enlightened Sexism, the Seductive Message That Feminism's Work Is Done. Welcome to RealityCast, Susan.
Well, thanks for having me.
In your book, you argue that feminism has indeed altered pop culture, but it hasn't necessarily been for the better. Can you talk about what this concept that you have of enlightened sexism is and where you find it?
Yes, you know, I think the mass media are very mixed, and there are new empowered images of women that have responded to women's real desires to have role models in the media and to have images of women as successful, you know, career women and so on and so forth. But that has been given permission for the rise of much more retrograde sexist images that, you know, back in the 70s and 80s, women and even men railed against. And so enlightened sexism is this new sneaky, subtle form of sexism. And what enlightened sexism does is that it insists that full equality for women has been achieved. And therefore, we don't need feminism anymore. In fact, feminism should be repudiated. And thus, it's okay to, and even funny to resurrect these sexist images of women because they allegedly can't hurt us anymore.
Can you give some examples?
Sure. you know, this book came out of a variety of motivations, and one of them was being the mother of a teenage daughter and watching what was on offer for her and how different that was from what was on offer for me. So I would watch my daughter see, for example, the real world in which young women increasingly were made to be highly sexualized and have cat fights over men they barely knew, and to obsess about relationships, or Sorority Life, another reality TV show in which the same themes occurred, The Bachelor, in which 25 very attractive women compete for the affections of one guy, and he samples the wares of all of them until he decides which one he likes best, the explosion in makeover shows. You know, all of these together have added up to an emphasis for young women that they have to be very hyper-feminine, that they should focus the bulk of their attention on consumerism, shopping, men, and being hot.
The other concept that I thought was kind of interesting that you kick around in the book is that of what you call embedded feminism. What is that, and where do you find that?
Embedded feminism refers to the fact that feminism is no longer outside of popular culture the way it was in, say, 1970. Feminism is now embedded into the weft and warp of all kinds of media texts. And so a lot of female achievements are taken for granted. Producers want to show women as surgeons or district attorneys or judges. And the irony of this is that because that has occurred, we now have an over-representation of women's achievements in the media that is all out of proportion to how the vast majority of girls and women live their lives.
Do you think that people who watch a lot of TV really do get the impression that women are doing better than they are?
Well, you know, people aren't complete media dupes, and we do talk back to television. And there are certainly millions of women out there who are struggling to keep their families intact financially and emotionally, who know, because it's their lived experience, that most women are not, in fact, chiefs of police or high-powered surgeons. But nonetheless, what the media do when they magnify and exaggerate certain kinds of images over and over, over others, a new common sense kind of gets constructed. And so if you no longer have shows like Roseanne or Grace Under Fire that showed working-class women or single mothers, and instead have a dramatic overemphasis on women who have in one way or another cracked the glass ceiling, it does contribute to a kind of common sense that, oh yeah, women, they have achieved full equality. They do have it made. And it's a kind of common sense that just missed through our culture until it seems like it's the truth and real when it isn't.
On that topic, one of the most painful chapters for me to read personally was the one about warrior women in thongs.
Yeah.
I mean, I love shows like Buffy the Vampire Slayer, though some of the ones that inspired you talk about I've never watched. But I thought your argument about how that kind of show could be very problematic was a good one. Can you kind of explain to the listeners what some of the problems are with these warrior women images?
Yeah, well, I think what the media have done is they've been offering us fantasies of power. And because they're fantasies, they're delicious, and we love them. And Buffy, for example, was created by Joss Whedon, who was a self-proclaimed feminist man who was tired of seeing girls as the victims in horror films, and he wanted one to be a hero. And so, you know, Buffy became a huge cult hit. It lasted for many years. People loved it, still do. TV Guide named it one of the best shows ever. And so we love the fact that she was the one, that a high school girl, you know, was the one who could save the entire planet from the Hellmouth. And isn't that a delicious fantasy? It is. At the same time, Buffy was often the most scantily clad of all the girls in the high school. She was kicking butt in her miniskirts and, you know, low-cut tops. And the message was that you can be strong and powerful as long as you're busty, beautiful, and a size zero. And it's that kind of fusion of femininity and feminism that, on the one hand, we're all struggling to achieve, and on the other hand, emphasized a real narrow definition of hyper-femininity and beauty that most of us can't really achieve.
You know, reading your book, I was actually put in mind of all these books and articles that are out now about the so-called perfect girl syndrome, where young women feel like they have to be beautiful and smart and powerful and all these things effortlessly or seemingly effortlessly. Do you think that the media has a large role in this syndrome?
Yes, absolutely, I do. I mean, look at young people today and how much media they consume. They are experts at multitasking. They can watch television, listen to their iPod, be on Facebook, talking on their cell phone all at the same time. This is the most marketed to generation ever. And so these kinds of images do have an enormous impact on young women because they construct a particular kind of norm that is magnified and exaggerated over and over again until it seems like this is the one, the only standard of beauty, this is the only one way to be. And it's not that people don't see through it, it's not that people are duped, but it gets very hard to resist when it's just hammered into you over and over again.
I really liked your chapter on the explosion in tabloids and obsessive monitoring of celebrity women's bodies, relationships, childbearing, anything but their careers. And it's kind of surprising to me that something like this has become so popular because it's so overtly sexist. What do you make of that?
Well, it is overtly sexist, and I think one of the things that happened after 9/11, when actually I see enlightened sexism really getting bloated, is that politics and the world became scary. Many young people, and certainly women, were told to go away, that politics was not anything they could affect and was irrelevant to them. And yet, you know, national information and national news is the kind of glue that holds us together. And at the same time, there was a complete explosion in celebrity journalism. Well, the stories about relationships and love and women's friendships and babies, you know, women are supposed to be experts on that and to bring a kind of judgment to it. So I think one of the appeals of celebrity journalism has been to provide a space where we have common stories about famous people that we can discuss. We can judge them. We have the expertise to judge them, and it actually matters. I mean, when you see what happened to Tom Cruise's, you know, monetary value after he, you know, jumped up on Oprah's sofa, then, you know, locked his wife up in a tower like Rapunzel, and finally, you know, took on Brooke Shields because she had postpartum depression, the reaction against him was serious, and it undermined his box office value. Now, you know, that's power. So celebrity journalism provides a kind of a moral universe where women's opinions matter. And also in celebrity journalism, women are the center of the universe. There are, of course, the cheating boyfriends and husbands, but it's women who drive these stories. Now, what you pay for in exchange is the incredibly increasing surveillance of women's bodies, the bump patrol, which I think is one of the creepiest things to emerge in recent years, where they're actually trying to get inside your uterus and figure out what's going on. It's like a combination of stalking and government surveillance that I find especially creepy. And it is, you're right, very sexist.
So I've got time for one more question. One thing I can't get over is how much the media churns out images of what I would call, like, sexualized virgins. And they're not maybe necessarily virgins, but it's young women getting this message that you should both look and act like you're on constant sexual display, but you're also shamed if you, you know, actually want sex. So what do you make of that?
Well, we live in a society that is prudish and pornographic at exactly the same time. You're supposed to be hot as can be and just say no. Now, just think about the contradictions young women have to straddle around something like that. And, you know, to get back to your earlier point about how young women feel they have to be everything to everybody, there have been studies about this that show that young women feel they have to be supergirls, superwomen, that they have to achieve all kinds of things in, you know, their academic studies, in sports, and yet they have to be a size zero, busty, and gorgeous. And these are very difficult standards and contradictions for them to straddle.
My guest today has been author Susan Douglas, and her book is called Enlightened Sexism: The Seductive Message That Feminism's Work Is Done. It's available at bookstores everywhere and online. Thanks for coming on to RealityCast, Susan.
Thanks for having me.
Okay, enough with the talk about the political ball playing that got the healthcare bill passed. The question now is, what about that executive order that Obama signed in order to give Stupak a reason to vote for the bill? What does it do? What does it not do? There are many questions about this.
President Obama promising an executive order ensuring no changes to tight restrictions on federally funded abortions. I thought that is what that allusion was too.
Technically speaking, it's an extension of current law, but only because there was no healthcare exchange prior to this. Now the ban will extend into the healthcare exchange. Many feminists are experiencing Obama's decision as a betrayal, and I think they kind of think Hillary Clinton wouldn't have done this. I strongly disagree, I'm afraid. By not going straight to the left in the first place and demanding a repeal of the Hyde Amendment, pro-choicers conceded the argument about the federal government's right to try to manipulate women's choices through funding. Poor women, military women, and federal employees were thrown under the bus a long time ago under the Hyde Amendment, and this is a continuation of that theme. The real issue is what now? The small sliver of hope that the Hyde Amendment could be overturned was based on the fact that it comes up for renewal as part of the budget every year, and in theory, it could be removed if there was a political will to do so. But now it's backed up by this executive order from the president. Does that mean we're doomed forever? Stupak hopes so.
You do have some legal experts, and a lot of folks, critics of yours, saying today that they're confused by your thinking on this. They say, look, executive orders cannot overrule the law, that it takes congressional action. So does this bill, which you now voted for, contain federal funding for abortion, in your opinion?
The bill, but the executive order clarifies it. The executive order has the full force and effect of law. You know, it's interesting. These same critics, when George W. Bush put the executive order out for stem cell research, remember, limit the stem cell research, these same critics said it was wonderful, it was welcome news, we applaud it. Now President Obama does an executive order and suddenly it's no good.
But here's a couple of things. For one thing, the president can always issue another executive order overturning the prior one if he wants. So there's hope there. Second of all, there are wording issues in the executive order that may mean that Obama was hedging his bets. After all, he's on the record, with RH Reality Check, in fact, as formally opposing the Hyde Amendment. At no point in time has Obama indicated any reason to think he supports continuing it except out of political expediency. And this is reflected in the executive order. Congresswoman Jane Schakowsky explained this on the Rachel Maddow Show.
Let me just read to you. It says, the president has said from the start that this health insurance reform should not be the forum to upset long-standing precedent. The health care legislation and this executive order are consistent with this principle. So I think the president actually went out of his way to make sure that he was not codifying Hyde. I know that Bart used that language on the floor. He said that this codifies Hyde. It does not. Codify specifically means put in statutory language, and it doesn't do that. This is still part of the regulations. And there's still absolutely room for the pro-choice caucus to move ahead.
At current time, getting women the funding they deserve for abortion seems like a long shot. However, this entire ruckus has reminded the public of the problem of trying to access abortion if you can't afford it. Now that it's on the public's radar, this is a good time politically to try to move the ball down the field. And now for the Wisdom of Wingnuts, Hyperbole Edition. Michael Steele was on Fox News defending the hyperbolic rhetoric from the right on the issue of healthcare reform passing.
They're saying around the
kitchen
table.
Armageddon? Seriously?
Yes. Listen to what the people are saying. This is what they're feeling,
Armageddon,
Chef.
Would you like a definition
of that? Why is this so surprising to you?
Armageddon? Because I read about Armageddon, and I'm not sure that these two things equate.
Understand it from the perspective of a small business owner
who's getting a tax credit and a tax break.
Oh, come on.
That's what the legislation says.
When even an anchor on Fox News, of all places, is correcting you and telling you that you're going too far, well, you've been going too far for too long.
That's it for this week's edition of Reality Check. Please tune in next week for another dose of reality in the sexual health debate. Visit www.rhrealitycheck.org and sign up for our weekly e-newsletter, various news feeds, and daily emails. Thanks for listening and see you next week.